Thanks again to everyone who's read, helped us open the meeting. Welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Particular welcome to any visitors or newcomers that might be with us this evening. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So we are a speaker meeting, and it falls on me to introduce our speaker this evening tonight. This particular individual I've known for a long time. He was actually in the very first online meeting I ever went to. And our paths have woven together over the years in all kinds of different and interesting ways, sometimes close and sometimes not so close. And I do know that he's celebrating a fairly major milestone of recovery later on this year. I'd forgotten that, but there we go, it is what it is. He's part of our home groups. He's been coming to Hignall for a long time, and without any further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Steve J, who's come along to share his experience, strength and hope with us tonight for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with. So Steve, floor is yours, my friend. Please share with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
My name's Steve and I'm an addict. Can everybody hear?
Hi, Steve. Lovely to see you.
Loud and clear.
Well, welcome. What a welcome. Lovely. Thank you. Thanks for asking me to share. Thank you for Steve doing service and people in the background doing the moderating. It's a real honour to, one, be alive, and two, that anybody would want to listen. I've only got one story and I've got a very bad memory, so I will try and start at the start and give you my experience of what it was like, what it's like now, and how I got to that. Okie doke. Just before the meeting started, I was sketching, I was drawing stuff, which always calms me down and gets me to focus. And I've been praying hard to just be able to share my truth, my experience. Okay, so going back to the very beginning, born, bred, and brought up in Wales, in the UK. And from about birth to about 3 or 4, I was a happy, weird, lovable, attentive, inquiring little child. And at the age of 4 and a half, my parents decided to uproot from Wales to England, south of England, to a place I can only describe as hell. And I didn't like it. I was scared, frightened, didn't fit in at all. I had a Welsh accent, I had Welsh parents, and I was surrounded by weirdos that spoke with an English accent in various degrees, from Cockney to El-Hilal. Different classes, different people, different environments. And my parents took me to my first school, and I can't remember speaking to anyone apart from one of the teachers to explain how frightened I was and that I didn't like this place. I don't fit in, this is horrible. I've got no friends, look at me, you know, ginger hair, freckles, skinny, and I spoke differently to everybody else. And I was told, it's all right, it'll get better. From that moment, I was lied to. It didn't get better, it got worse, a hell of a lot worse. I got bullied. Constantly. I got made fun of, laughed at, and when I told my parents what was going on, they said the same lie. It's all right, it'll get better. Well, it never did. From the age of 4 to 9, I went to a couple of schools, as you do, in the nursery and secondary, the next one up, middle school. Same thing happened, got bullied, got laughed at. And I was a really slow learner. I believe there was something kind of wrong with how I learned, and I'll go on to that later in my share, because there was. And I was bullied for that, and I was put in segregated classrooms, labelled as someone that, you know, just doesn't learn. He's rebellious, he's a thug, he's a clown, he's this, he's that, but it never gave me an opportunity to listen to when I expressed I don't learn how you're teaching me. Anywho, went from 8 or 9, getting bullied, blah, 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 went into my secondary school, and on the first day of school, I hid in a patch of stinging nettles on the way to school, wait for everybody to go in so that I could then go. I succeeded in doing that, but then when I entered the kind of assembly hall, I was told to stand up for being late and all laughed at by all the children. Made an example of saying that this is what we don't want at our school. We want prompt people turning up. We don't want people turning up late and disrupting. And I was then told to go to the office afterwards and talk to what was then the headmaster and the deputy head. When I was introduced to them, they scared the crap out of me. One of them was a ex-prison warden who learned how to deal with them by just beating the shit out of them, which he then later did it, you know, in the secondary school on a regular occasion with unruly kids at school. There was a pack of teachers that were very, very quite used to giving out violence towards the children, and nothing was done. Nothing was ever done about it. It was very common to get punched by the teachers, kicked by the teachers, left out of sports, left out of class, told to stand outside for hours on end. And I guess the worst part about being the bullied person is that it came from the children and the adults. And then when I expressed it to my parents, I got even worse beatings from my father for not standing up for myself. This went on till I was about 14, and then I rebelled against my father, punched him in his nether regions as hard as I could possibly do, which I lived to regret. Not now, but then, because it was only a few weeks later he beat the living crap out of me. I wasn't hospitalised because my parents didn't want anybody to know what had happened. Looking back, I should have been. Anyway, so school, nightmare all the way through. Couldn't wait to leave. Got very disruptive in the end. I kind of become what they thought I was at the start, you know what I mean, because I never turned up for school. And I get started to mix with a few people that were drinking at school. They used to bring these little tiny miniatures of scotch and brandy and stuff into school. So I experimented with that, and then I started with Tipex thinners, which you poured onto your sleeve, inhaled fumes, and it changed the way you felt, and I loved it. It put me in that place where I didn't have to care what other people thought of me. I went on to smoke marijuana pretty quickly after leaving school, and tried other little things. But the things like trips and stuff like that didn't really agree with me, so I didn't go for those. But uppers and downers, we went for those. When I flipped to about 18, 19, I had a problem. I had a problem with drink. I had a problem with drugs. And I couldn't understand why everybody else wouldn't want this problem. Because I couldn't see it as a problem, but looking back at my history, that's really when it started to become every day rather than something to do at the weekend. I decided it was the place where I was living which was the problem, and I'd always wanted to get out of England. So when I was 21, I had the opportunity, I saved some money from a shit job that I was in, and I travelled to Australia. And I landed in Bali, first of all, beautiful Indonesian island, which was paradise. It was away from England, beautiful weather, beautiful people, cheap beer, cheap everything, all spirits, drugs, women. So I had a field day, and I ended up spending the equivalent of when I was supposed to be traveling for a year. I ended up spending virtually all my year's money in 3 weeks in an Indonesian island where everything was cheap. I ended up selling most of my clothes, bartering it for drink and drugs, and prostitutes. And yeah, I spent a lot of money. And when I touched down in Sydney, 3 weeks into the trip, I knew I had to get some more money to supply me with the drugs and drink that I needed for the rest of the trip. So I manipulated an old girlfriend who was living in the UK and had a steady job at the bank. And I knew she had a good resource of money. We got on quite well. So I rang her up and told her how amazing it was in Australia. And she should come out. You know, you wouldn't believe it out here. It's beautiful. It's that the streets are paved with gold. You can get jobs. You can work. You can go on the beach. You can have barbies. The food's cheap. The drink's cheap. You've got to be there. You're missing out. And to my fucking surprise, a couple of weeks later, literally, she rings me up from Sydney Airport telling me she's jacked the job. She's got a payout. And she's at Sydney Airport waiting for me to pick her up. Whew, it blew my head off. And my head was happily thinking, right, I've got lots of money coming my way. Not a thought for the lady, what she just sacrificed. And how was I going to look after her while she was out there and protect her from, you know, all the debt. Weird people that I was associated with, other travellers that were taking shitloads of drugs. She wasn't really a drug taker, and I hadn't really shown her much of mine. So, as you can imagine, she saw it virtually straight away. In fact, she saw it on the very first day I was there, when she arrived. And after a very short time, she said, you know, this is fucking ridiculous. All you do is drink, take drugs, and what I've just heard from one of the other people that you're traveling with is that you shag other women. And she had my number, so I didn't know what to do. I was like, uh-oh, she's caught me. Okay, we need to make a plan. So I did what I always did, and I said, sorry, I won't do it again. Trust me. You know, it'll be okay. Won't revert back to the lie that I was told years ago. As in, it wasn't okay. After a few more weeks, we travelled around a little bit, but my drinking got worse. I couldn't drive when we had to drive across Australia, and crashed the car a few times, got into some fights, mainly with the people I was travelling with, to be honest. Because I was running out of drink and they wouldn't give me theirs, so I'd scrap over that. I'd piss on the relationships that I had. Eventually they got pissed off of it and booted me out, and I was left with just her, and that wasn't going to work. So she left. She got an internal flight back to Sydney, and she fucked off, and we never spoke. We didn't actually spoke for years. until meeting up again and doing a short form of amends later on in life. Anywho, when I got back from Australia in a fucking horrific mess, addiction had extremely increased. Now taking anything and anybody's at any time, always having it on tick and getting myself in shitloads of debt. So my answer to that was to look for another woman. And I was in my local pub getting pissed same day, same night, everything like I normally did. And I saw this lady put some money into a jukebox. I recognised her, apart from she was different. She had blonde hair and massive breasts and a little mini skirt and a crop top and a pint in her hand. And I introduced myself. I said, "Remember me? I'm your very first kiss." And she went, "I remember it well. That's why I put the song on." And it was Hot Chocolate, all about that very first kiss at school. She was my very first kiss where I experimented with women. And cut a long story short, within 3 weeks, we got together, came around the house, we took drugs together, took ecstasy, and we drank hock, a couple of litres of hock, which is a fucking horrible wine, cheap as hell, but it gets you pissed. And she proceeded to pass out. I took her upstairs. She threw up all over my parents' house, and can't really remember much of it. She went home. A couple of days later, I rang her up. "Said, we going out again or what?" You know, yeah, no problem. So I was like, "Oh, okay." And we started to take drugs quite regularly. We were doing it raves, going here, there, and everywhere. And we had a lot of fun, to be honest. You know, we did some stupid shit, but we had some fun. And we had a lot of sex, because, like I said, she was a very well-endowed woman, and she had all the assets that I liked. She was good at oral sex. She drank a hell of a lot. She took drugs all the time. And she had a car and some money. So I kind of abused and manipulated every one of those until there was nothing left. She sold her car. She lost her job. I got her pregnant. I got her skin. And our relationship was shit. And to solve that, in a pissed up haze one night, I said we should get married. And fuck knows how, but a week later we were. A registry office, no one there apart from two people we grabbed in the local newsagent to witness our marriage, which was horrific. She turned up in black and she was pregnant, so she couldn't fit in nothing. And we turned up in a little Fiat 127, little bubble car, which she could hardly get in. It was being heavily pregnant. And it pop and bang banged, and it got there but broke down at the registry office. Ended up leaving it there and walking out. Got very drunk that night. My missus started a fight with some woman that was at a party afterwards. We'd all gone back from the pub and she started to lay into this bird. So I laid into her other half for trying to break it up, and we both got clouted a few times. Blacked out, went to bed, can't remember how the hell I got home because it was miles away from the party. I can only think someone took us home. And then when I woke in the morning, I woke to, "Are you going to say good morning, Mrs. Johnson?" And I can honestly say that, one, I couldn't remember doing it, and two, it was like my face must have shown it all. It was like, "You're having a fucking laugh." And what I remember about it was she hit me with a stiletto heel in my face, which punctured my cheek. And then I went to go to the fridge to get me a normal drink to still that situation. And there was no drink. There was half a tomato and half a pint of milk. And I thought, right, I've got to get out of here as soon as possible. So I walked the streets picking up fag butts because I had no money, and I was devising the next plan on one, how to get out of this marriage, two, where the fuck am I going to get my drugs from? So the marriage got heated, got violent, did things that I'd regret to a very big extent. I was loyal and faithful, but only because I was never sober enough to actually commit being with another woman. Wasn't capable of doing that, capable of thinking it and acting out with women, but not actually, you know, go off of them. And after about 3 years, my missus went off with my neighbour. 6'6", massive-handed, left-handed cage fighter. And if I could tell you loads of stories about that, but bottom line, one night, we got into a scuffle. She shouted out the window for help. He come over. I ended up grabbing his throat and sticking him into the bathroom. And I hung him distant above the toilet. I have no old-fashioned Victorian toilets, and I hung him from that and connected a towel around my arm and around his neck and waited for him to hang off it. And I let him go and went back into the other room where, unfortunately, my son was awake in his room. And I kind of hid in there for a bit thinking, right, well, I'll just wait for him to die or calm down. I didn't know if he was alive or not. I knew he was pretty blue when I left him. And the next thing, the door opens, and it's my missus. I step back and then got run at by her boyfriend, her new man, who then hit me with his left hand when I was expecting the right hand. So hard, he kind of punched through my face, and he ruined my face. I knocked out completely. He'd broken my nose, my cheekbone, my eyelid socket. Fractured that. And when I woke, I was actually getting into an ambulance. And show you how much of a lovely guy I was back then. They were putting the mask on so I could get some oxygen. I actually punched the nurse, the female that was in the ambulance, told her where to put the mask. I was taken to local hospital, which I stayed there for a long time. Because one, I couldn't sober up when I was in there. I kept drinking while I was in hospital. And two, there was complications with the operations that I had to have. I think I had 3 major surgeries on my face. And 2 of them totally went wrong due to the fact I was drunk and incooperative. Right, moving on. Unfortunately, the marriage had to end. I had to leave the house. I had to leave my child. Start again in my life. Solely put down all this to not being able to stop drinking and not being able to drink the way I wanted, not being able to use the way I wanted. And I was starting to lose a lot of people around me and starting to pick up with a lot of unsightly people, dangerous people. Moving on. It was a bit of a blur from 94 to about 2000. My life was a blur. Stayed over on people's houses. Managed to get a place in a YMCA hostel. Well, I lived in one room and one saucepan. And loads of drugs. Dealt drugs. Went with women that dealt drugs. Escalated my drug use every evening. And it got worse and worse and worse. And my last hostage I took, a lady that I was with about 8 or 9 years that time, in that blackout time. We had a stepson of a 9-year-old, and he witnessed some of the heaviest, worst drug use I ever had. And I ended up leaving her when I first got into recovery. I was introduced to the other fellowship when I was 35 years of age. I reached a point where I knew that drink had took over my life, and I also knew I couldn't stop it. So I went to the other fellowship and I proceeded to get sober and take lots of drugs. I smoked lots of marijuana, took lots of speed. Every now and again I might have some ecstasy, but I was not drinking right, so my life was improving. I ended up getting a little flat and still lying and cheating to everybody, but you know, going to AA regularly. And then one day in AA, one of my AA members, a guy called Alan, high down south, he came up to me outside a meeting and stuffed me against the wall by my neck and said, I'm sick of listening to you. I'm sick of you killing yourself and killing others with your message of recovery. I want you to fuck off and go to NA. You need help, and you need more help than we're offering. And you ain't helping by being here. So fuck off and find yourself some recovery somewhere else. And I'm not letting you back in the second half of the meeting. Which I got on my little scooter and fucked off. And I drove off at a speed, you know, on my little scooter. And I thought, well, what a wanker, you know. Don't he know what I'm doing here? Well, I think he did. And I steadily got worse. The marijuana had stopped working years before, but I was still abusing it. And I was left once again shivering denizen, sat on the floor, praying, or I don't know what, and saying, right, this is it. And I can remember shouting out, I don't know who you are, where you are, if you wear a fucking dress, if you've got a beard, if you don't stop me using, I'm going to die. Do it, and do it now, please. And I went back to the house that I was still allowed in, just, and I prayed again and again and again. And I went to bed that night, and I woke up about 4 o'clock in the morning sweating, and my first thought wasn't to use something. So I took that and I told my missus at the time, I said, look, you know, I don't want to use. And she was like, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, fuck off, go back to sleep. Anyway, that day I made a decision because my sponsor turned up at my house and said, it's just no way I can sponsor you anymore. In fact, I'm going to section you. He worked for the local nut house as well as AA and had his own business. And he had a section paper saying that, you know, it's indefinite that I was going to stay in the nut house for a while with no way of getting out. So I agreed with him that I convinced him, manipulated him that, okay, I'll go to a meeting. I'll go to an NA meeting. He took me down, threw me out, stuck me in the meeting, so call me in 6 months when you actually get some recovery in you. And my journey in NA started. I went into a meeting, I saw a handful of people that I'd seen in AA, which made it even more embarrassing. But I'd had everything kicked out of me. I was empty, hollow, depressed, but loneliness that I can only describe as pretty fucking yellow. And I had nothing to live for. I'd lost everything. So I asked for help. I got down on my knees in the meeting and said, please, one of you help me. I can't do this on my own. I'm going to die. And one of the guys did help me. He said, I've got a job for you. I want you to shut the door after the meeting. And there was a big stone there that said love on it, been painted on it. And it was quite a big pebble. And he said, right, I want you to put that, pull it away from the door, and the door will shut. So I did that. Explained to him that, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do, and what am I going to do for the next hour? It's all right for the meeting, but what about after that? And that, you know, the same old NA response, please keep coming back, you'll be all right. Got some numbers, and I had a lot of these numbers anyway from the other fellowship. thankfully I had their numbers. And I started to ring them. I started to ring a few and say, you know, let's get together, let's go and get to a meeting. I didn't have the ability of getting to meetings on my own because I didn't have a car, so I got a lift, thankfully, by a lot of people in the fellowship. Until I managed to get a car, I financed a cheap shit run around, and then I became the person taking other people, which was lovely. You know, it was like a responsibility that I never asked for, but I ended up taking other newcomers to meetings. And I kept up with the NA and AA simply for convenience. Back in High Wycombe at that time, there was only two or three NA meetings, but there was a lot of AA, so I ended up doing both. And then I think I was 5 years, 4 or 5 years clean when I made a decision. Might have been a bit longer, actually. Made a decision that I just needed one fellowship, even if it was two or three meetings a week. I'll travel, you know, I'll go further afield and make that 4 or 5 meetings a week. I did it for the first 3 years, well, 2 years and 8 months. I did a meeting every single day, sometimes 2 or 3 a day. And I think that made a really good foundation for my life. I listened to what people said, but I was pretty damn sick when I first come round. It took a long time for me to get round to doing the steps. Took a lot of time to choose a sponsor and find one that I could work with, really work with, you know, get honest and know that I could trust them. So let's move on. 7 years into recovery, I had a breakdown, emotionally, physically, mentally, fucked. And I wanted to use so bad. It was horrific. Everything seemed to go wrong again. I couldn't find my place anywhere. Didn't feel comfortable in the meetings, didn't feel comfortable at home. So eventually, I guess it was a combination of being stubborn and just sticking with staying clean. And then talking to different people in the fellowship about my experience and how they related that, you know, there's certain times in recovery you do actually break down. There might be another level within yourself that you need to go to. I call this level the mid-tone. I'm an artist, so it's like dark, light, and mid-tone. And that's the mid-tone I have to look for. And normally it comes from getting honest with a sponsor. You know, I know a lot of people will relate to doing another round of steps or writing out another problem or making another amends or whatever. Mine has been periodically finding that one individual that I can actually share how I feel, work myself through that, navigate through it, to find some sort of acceptance. Because for me, it says in our literature, acceptance is the key. Absolutely. And if I can't find it, I'm in trouble. So I have to get honest again. And a lot of that stuff now, looking back, I know it was sexual behaviours. You know, me wanting someone else to fix the way I was feeling about myself and not being able to use drink or drugs or manipulation or this or that to fix the way I was feeling. To find acceptance that can't take another hostage in order to fix the way I feel. So, yeah, that periodically has come up quite a few times in my recovery. 7 years, 11 years, 12 and a half years. Yeah, floated around 16 years, started to happen again. And I always remember what my sponsor says, you know, it's like, always remember there's one plate spinning, you know. There's always a plate spinning, Steve. Can't turn addiction off. You can monitor it. You can try and manipulate it. You have to accept that there's always something you're using. And you have to weigh up what's the detrimental effect on you, your life, and everybody else. Because there's always one plate spinning. You'll never stop them all. You never become perfect. Never become fixed. Addict. You are an addict. Your switch is always on. And it's always looking for another way of expressing itself. Never really positively. always detrimental. And that's been in my experience. There is always one thing spinning that I can have no control over at all. And I have to get acceptance of that fact rather than try and fix it. And then move on, you know, move on with whatever my life is doing at that time. I've been unfortunate to get illness in recovery, but fortunate that HIGNA and many other meetings I go to online have saved my life. There's at least 10 people in this meeting here that have contributed to saving my life by being in a meeting regularly. They're like my little brothers and sisters. They're people that I can go to with anything. All the shit that I carry, all my messed up thinking, my distorted way of looking at stuff, my unmanageability, my low self-esteem, my net self-worth, they're all there, you know, they're all there. And everyone's contributed in their own little way, whether it's listening and meeting, sharing a bit of your experience, or ringing me up afterwards, saying, look, you know, it's all right, you just fucked. Like you normally are, but you know, don't use, you'll be all right. And that's been invaluable to my recovery. You know, I haven't spoke much about step work. There's lots of people that can explain that. It doesn't come into my share a lot. Yes, it's very important. Yes, I've been through the 12 and 12, the green and gold. Yes, I've done the big book, 12 steps. To me, it's like, can I cope with my irritability, my discontentment, my low self-esteem, and still be a Steve? Nothing else, just Steve. Up until today, I've come very close to not being, but I haven't had to use or reach for a drink or drug in order to fix the way Steve's feeling. I haven't done everything right. I've made shitloads of mistakes, but the biggest one I haven't used since I've come. Since that very first day of the meeting, very first NA meeting. And like Steve said, in a few months I'll celebrate a big milestone. And that's come because of everybody that sits and attends and is a part of my life. And I might not ring them regularly, but I'm always regular in meetings. So I see and I hear their journeys and I try and support them when obviously they're struggling or they're coming up to a phase of recovery that they're not going to get through on their own. I hear them, you know, and hopefully they hear me. Their journey has been like snakes and ladders. My life since I met NA and joined and did what was suggested. I go along great for a while and then I... I'll reach out, someone help, please someone help, please someone listen, I can't do this. And many of you know, because you've heard my journey, you've heard it regularly, I can't do it on my own, I need your help, I still think I'm fucked up, you know, what do I have to do? And I've never had anything but, don't use today, Steve. It'll be okay, but not the old lie from my parents, you know, it'll be all right, everything will work out. Not that. Yeah, okay, Steve, if you feel like shit, you don't know why there's a reason to live, you're depressed, you're not well, you're not eating, please don't use. Just don't use today, just for the next few minutes while we're chatting. And I've had people in my life, and I still have them, who have been that person. That have dropped everything to be on the call for a good 2 hours, talking me down from that place of I want to die and I can't cope and I need to use. And I will be forever indebted to them, as I am many of the members of NA who actually started this. They created something that truly works. It offers you a snakes and ladders life, a place where you can be crazy. You can be serene, you know, you can be what, you can be you, you know, they can, you can actually eventually be you and not worry so much about others one thinking what you are, because it's none of my business what other people think of me. Somewhere in that lot, I've blurted out me, my experience of NA, how it was, how it is now. If you got something from it, great. If you didn't, please keep coming to another meeting, because there's millions of us, and you will hear something that will help you, and it encourage you to keep coming back, because any addict can stop using, lose the desire to use again, and find a new way through NA to live without drugs. I think I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate you listening. Please come, keep coming back, everybody.